I'm Sima Shapiro, the host of the new Contemporary Lifestyle Radio Show for women over 40, featuring everything about your health, wealth, children, happiness, and anything else of interest to you, the listener. Please stay tuned. Hi, I'm Sima Shapiro, your host of For Women Over 40. Today we'll be talking with two powerhouse women who are passionate about empowering other women to achieve their worth as mothers, find equality in the workplace, gain financial independence, and provide guidance regarding women's issues. In doing so, we'll examine the current state of motherhood in the U.S. Ann Crittenden is an award-winning journalist, author, and lecturer. She is the author of If You Raise Kids, You Can Manage Anything, and The Price of Motherhood. Ann was a reporter for the New York Times for 8 years, writing on a broad range of economic topics. She initiated numerous investigative reports and was nominated for the Pulitzer Prize. She has also been a financial writer and foreign correspondent for Newsweek, a reporter for Fortune magazine, a visiting lecturer for MIT and Yale, an economics commentator for CBS News, and executive director of the Fund for Investigative Journalism. Ann is married, has one son, and lives in Washington, D.C. Valerie Young is a public policy analyst who represents Momentum, an organization which empowers and educates women in Washington, D.C. She is an advocate for recognition of mothers' contributions to our national welfare and a proponent of economic security and independence for those who are for family members. Valerie also educates policymakers who work on issues pertinent to women. She is the author of Momentum Advocacy, E-News, and blogs weekly at Your Woman in Washington. Her work also appears in the Shriver Report, Brainchild Magazine, and Blogger. She lives with her husband and two children in Kensington, Maryland. So welcome, Valerie and Ann.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Glad to be here.
So, Ann, briefly tell me about your life journey and interest in doing this work.
Well, it was very personal. When I had my son, I was on leave from the New York Times, and I discovered right away that the job of being a mother was not as prestigious as the job of being a reporter for the New York Times. And the moment I reported my book that a lot of women identified with was when someone at a Washington cocktail party said, "Hey, didn't you used to be Ann Crittenden?" So I thought, you know what? This is the hardest job I've ever had, and it's the least respected. So I better start finding a way to write about this. So my goal was to make it clear that raising a child conscientiously is the most important job in the entire economy, and that we don't do half enough to reward that job financially, to recognize it. So that's it. Period.
Valerie?
I think it's really interesting that both Ann and I are on the program today, because it was all because of her and her book that I became aware of these issues surrounding motherhood and the economic impact of family care. I heard a radio interview, interestingly, since we're on the radio now, in 2002 with Ann, and she was talking about her book, and I realized that I had to read The Price of Motherhood, because what she was being interviewed about touched so many different parts of my life and made so much sense to what I had experienced but hadn't really ever heard talked about or didn't really have the right vocabulary for. So I started off by reading her book, and then since I live in Washington, it was easy to find out what advocacy organizations had going on here around the issue of women's rights, caregivers' rights, mothers in the workplace, pay equity, paid family leave. And so I just started following other advocacy organizations and really started to learn the subject matter from the ground up. And then eventually I was offered a job at one. So that's how it all started for me.
So let's get back to the current state of motherhood in the U.S. Valerie, to set the stage, let's start with some of the stats from your recent blog, stats from the U.S. Census Bureau. What can you share with us?
Well, every March, the U.S. Census Bureau puts out a great, very pithy fact sheet called Facts for Features Women's History Month. And you can look at them year after year if you want and see how progress has been made. What we know from looking at the most recent one that came out just a couple of months ago, actually just about 2 months ago, I think they released it in February, is that women are so integrated into the labor force, and they have also so immersed themselves in higher education to the point that women now have more advanced degrees than men do. But definitely women have become the better educated gender. However, it's very interesting to note that at the same time, women are putting off both marriage and motherhood. Now, obviously, I think they want to get established in their careers. They want to become economically secure. They want to get some of the benefits of all of this education they've received. But one thing that the statistics from the Census Bureau have shown is that women are having children at a slightly younger age than they're getting married. So there's a real increase in single motherhood in the 20s and 30s. The single motherhood in the teenage years has dropped dramatically. But women are still having children, and they are still getting married, but they're more likely to have children at a younger age than they are to actually get married. And I think that has some really interesting, perhaps, messages about gender, motherhood, relationships, and economics.
Tell me a little bit about your conclusions from all of this.
I sort of have a working theory. I wouldn't really call it a conclusion because I'm not sure, and I'd like to see a lot more research, and I think we'd also need more time. But my suspicions are that the more educated women are and the more they immerse themselves in the paid labor force, they realize that the institution of marriage reinforces traditional gender dynamics. And I wonder if they try to avoid or delay getting involved in those gender dynamics. On the other hand, the thought of having a child and being a mother, while of course it has some economic ramifications that are significant, and gender dynamics, it's a different kind of gender dynamics. And so they seem to be more willing to become mothers than they are to get married, or at least more willing to do it sooner. So I think there's some real gender dynamics at play. But again, just a working theory.
Anne, do you have any thoughts?
Well, I think it's also related to the fact that women are more economically independent than they used to be. So that it's not impossible to imagine raising a child on your own. In some communities, there are very few men available because of our high imprisonment rates. And in other communities, women are doing pretty well when they don't have children, so they can imagine financially supporting a child. So I think that's very important, too, in the single-parent realm. But I think clearly one last huge piece of unfinished business in the women's movement is to do something to make sure that people who are raising children are not falling below the poverty level, that we do have a support system, a community, or as a community or as a nation, to make sure our children are being raised with advantages that other kids in other countries are being raised. And we are not doing that. Well, about over 20% of American children are living in poverty. So that's, to me, one of the most damning things that's still going on.
Do you have any sense about economic and sociological shifts that are also going on in addition to what you just said?
I think Valerie touched on a lot of what's going on. Women are voting more than men are. They're still having children, though, despite the handicaps of motherhood. And we didn't mention that equivalently educated, trained, and all of that, women who are mothers are earning less than women without kids, and certainly a lot less than men with kids. So there's a huge motherhood penalty on your income. And yet, despite that, you know, we want to have children. And for our sake and for society's sake, that's a good thing.
I want to go back again, talking about where the message came in. For many of us, the message came in the 60s and 70s with people like Suzanne Braun Levine, who really exhorted us to follow our own passions, follow our own dreams without a partner, make sure that we were pursuing avenues that gave us pleasure, that helped us be successful. But I think that this has sort of helped us find discomfort at this kind of zeitgeist of all of these external factors. I think it's a really confusing time. Would you agree, Valerie?
Yeah, I would agree. And I think it can be made sense of by thinking about how much change women's roles have undergone, and women's ambitions and opportunities now are significantly more vast than they were in preceding decades. And yet, there has not been a commensurate change in our policy infrastructure. there's not been the same kind of change in how workplaces are functioning, how they're designed, who succeeds at them. I still find such a conflict between the change that women's roles have undergone and the traditional structures that we're still dealing with in policy, in legislation, and in our public and private institutions.
And yeah, to be fair, I don't think people like Susan Levine could imagine that the workforce structures would stay so rigid.
Right.
I mean, women have changed a lot, but the workplace has changed very little. And it was unimaginable that that could happen, I think. It's such a gap now between the way most women are living, most women are working. 47% of the workforce is women. Most mothers are working. But the workplace doesn't even acknowledge the fact that they're raising kids as well.
Part of the reason for that is the leadership gap. Even though more women are certainly employed in terms of the real policy and decision-making positions, we don't see anything near parity in those those decision-making roles. And so there's only you've only got 20% women in the U.S. Congress. And in terms of business, it's in the single digits in Fortune 500 CEOs. It's something like 5%. So one of the reasons it hasn't changed, in my, again, working theory opinion, is that once women get into their 30s, when they're more likely now to have children, especially the more educated women, they start getting their momentum is lost, and they don't continue on that career trajectory, which, were they men, would propel them into more authoritative decision-making positions. And so that's why I think you don't see that same kind of proportionate change in cultures and workplaces, because we're just not getting as high in the leadership as we need to be.
Yeah, I totally agree. It's still very, very male-dominated, particularly in business and in national politics. And we see a lot of misogyny. I think maybe people are shocked by what we're seeing with misogyny in this latest presidential race. There's some deep, ugly feelings that are still out there.
Let's talk about some solutions you might want to bring to the table. What would be some easy solutions that the listener could really kind of wrap their heads around? Do you have any thoughts?
I don't think any of them are easy.
They'd all been done by now.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. I wrote about this stuff for 30 years, and a lot of it has still not happened. So it isn't easy, and it's nothing happening on the national level. We have a frozen Congress that is unable to pass really meaningful legislation now for a number of reasons. But anyway, I think the most obvious thing that is moving slowly now, state by state, is paid leave when you have a child, paid leave when you're sick, which I'm sure your listeners are aware. We're the only country on earth, really, that doesn't allow or doesn't mandate a paid day off when your child is sick or you're sick. You have to go to work sick. Your kid has to go to daycare sick, whatever. And we don't have paid parental leave either mandated as a nation. But more and more states are slowly moving to make this happen. So that, to me, was easy, low-hanging fruit 30 years ago, and it's still just barely moving now.
It's still a struggle. I was at a conference with mothers over the weekend, and a woman came up to me, and she said, "I'm really interested in what you said about paid sick days. I had to take a day off because my child was sick and home from school, and when I came back to work the next day, I was suspended." So it's not necessarily that you just don't get the time off. You can be punished if you're trying to, you know, take care of your kid, which is really absurd.
There's no job protection. No job protection for tens of millions of workers.
But in terms of solutions, I think one lever I would like to see pulled is women and people who support things like paid leave and caregiver rights in the workplace, get in touch with your members of Congress and your state legislatures. Women in particular, and mothers even more so, are very reluctant to ask for something in their own interest because they think it's selfish or they've been told it's somehow undesirable or unattractive. If we could get in the habit of communicating with the people that we elect and whose paycheck we provide the funds for and say, "Hey, some paid leave already," or "How about paid sick days?" or "We really need some help with this paycheck fairness and making sure that men and women are paid the same."
You know, I'd like to add that this whole minimum wage movement, $15 minimum wage movement, is going to disproportionately really help women. two-thirds of part-time workers are, two-thirds of minimum wage workers are women, and many, many, maybe most of them are mothers. So that's an alliance with men that is moving, and it's moving very rapidly on state-by-state level. So women need to understand that minimum wage movement is really going to help alleviate child poverty and help people pay the bills who really need it to, and those are the women.
I find myself needing to go back one more time. Is there any other approach that you think would give better solutions to this, would propel...
What are you thinking?
I'm just asking you what kind of movement would need to be created in order to overhaul antiquated thoughts, beliefs, policies, and practices.
There are going on now. There are online platforms like I'm thinking of In Her Sight, and I'm thinking of List Your Leave, where employees can go and anonymously say, this was what my employer offered me when I was pregnant and going to have a baby. Or if you want to go work at this company, you should know that they do a great job of promoting women up the managerial ranks. Or at this company, I found out that I was being paid less. So outside of the policy world and outside of you know, public institutions, I'm really interested to see private actors, especially those that use technology, to do something called naming and shaming. I mean, corporations and employers are in a fight for talent now, and it's really cool to see women coming together and doing data gathering online and exerting pressure that way, because potential employers are going to want to look good, and they're going to want to attract talent. And I'm really pleased with these private micro, and not even so micro, initiatives, and I think they can get at the same place I'm trying to get to, but in the private policy realm. I mean, not policy, in the private action realm.
We're talking today with two women, Ann Crittenden and Valerie Young, about the current state of motherhood in the U.S. This is a period of time that I've written much about, the zeitgeist, the breakthroughs that are being made in medical technologies, new older parenthood, persistent involvement with ever-changing social media and technology. How do you address those external factors when you're trying to make an assessment about the current state of motherhood? Ann?
I'm not sure. I'll pass it to Valerie, I think.
God, I was hoping you'd answer first, because I'm not sure what I'm trying to get to.
Well, I'm saying to you, there's so many external things that are also contributing to this kind of state of flux we're in, and we seem to be perpetually in a state of flux. And it is because of these new pathways, you know, these breakthroughs in medical technologies allowing women new older parenthood, these non-traditional families being created, civil unions. You know, I think that all of this has some bearing on the state of motherhood in the U.S., but I would like a more global overview if one of you can provide it.
What I can offer here is also thinking about comments I heard at this conference just this past weekend with a number of mothers, was that none of them could have imagined what their lives would be like after they became mothers when they were just pregnant or hadn't even gotten pregnant yet. So something happens. It's like you're propelled into an entirely different reality almost. And then when you do become a mother, even at a later age, you find yourself incredibly busy and preoccupied, because making sure another creature stays alive is a very labor-intensive business. And these consistent themes seem to be that unless it happens to you, you don't really get the implications of it. And after mm-hmm. it happens to you, even with all the technology and the time-saving approaches we have, it's still such an all-consuming activity that it's hard to at that point say, oh my gosh, I can really see the need now for paid maternity leave, or I can really see the need now why we absolutely have to have quality child care, but between caring for the child and supporting myself, I can't actually do anything to make it better.
That's exactly where I was coming from.
In
relation to other countries, do you know where the U.S. stands on many of these issues in relation?
Oh, we're very behind. Not only are we behind time-wise, as Anne referenced before, we also spend so much less as a percentage of GDP in public investment and early education and care and in family supports and in promoting things like flexible scheduling, flexible workplace policy, things like that. Other countries have really been able to leverage the female half of their workforce, have access to them, and get their talent and abilities out there and into the economy. The workforce in the U.S. is so stymied and so hobbled, and there are real implications here for our future in the global economy and our competition ability in the international marketplace, because we're not
we're not
leveraging the women's portion of the workforce.
We also stand out on the medical healthcare situation. Until quite recently, as you know, we had no health care guaranteed to millions of people. And when the Affordable Care Act passed, it included many, many, many millions of women. It benefited, again, women extremely. We don't have to, in many ways, you don't have to have pregnancy or maternity benefits are not, or cesarean is not a pre-existing condition. More health benefits for women are included. I was just reading a new statistic on a health clinic in L.A. has a 44% increase in cervical cancer screenings because people can now go to the clinic. So we are just very slowly coming along what other countries have been doing for decades and decades, providing basic health care for women and men.
And I think we can think of basic health care as part of a national security issue. I mean, Anne-Marie Slaughter is talking about the status of women and mothers and their implications for our national security. These aren't women's issues. These are not niche or marginal issues.
Mm-mm.
They are fundamental economic policy and national security issues.
Exactly.
What are the reasons why the other countries are so far ahead of us? Is it cultural? What makes their awareness possible that we just don't see this?
I think one really overwhelming reason is the issue of race. I think there's been historically a huge resistance to programs that were perceived as benefiting the other people that don't look like us, kids that don't look like our kids, that kind of thing. Where a country is more homogenous racially and culturally, it's much easier for them to have social policies that help everybody, that help bring everybody up, that help avoid poverty. But we don't have that kind of homogeneity. And I think that racial divisions have been, many studies on this have explained a lot. Even to this day, I mentioned health care. The states that did not expand Medicaid are the states in the Deep South. And I think the reasons being that the beneficiaries would have been of a different race from those who have power.
Valerie, do you have any thoughts?
As a matter of fact, I do. I think when you look at our cultural history and the role of government, in the U.S., there's a real bold line of demarcation between family and everything that happens behind your front door, and then public life, which is everything that happens outside, on the other side of the front door. And that has perpetuated this idea that family matters should be kept separate and apart from things that the government might get involved in. So we sort of have this very individualized attitude, and I know you've heard the phrase, the government governs best which governs least. So it's the way we've conceived of government. Other countries say the nation has an interest in the welfare of its children. The nation has an interest in providing an economy that isn't just blowing and going, but an economy that provides opportunity for all of its citizens, even the female portion. And so they look at things like unpaid domestic labor and care and how that impacts the labor force and about income inequality. And we have one of the lowest tax countries in the world. So I think there are a lot of reasons for the difference, historical, conceptual, cultural, that kind of thing.
Do you envision that a certain sector or a certain section of the country will need to pull the remainder of the country along, since there are these deep divides?
Hard to answer that one.
What I'm hoping to see is some outrage. Coming out of the student loan crisis, when, first of all, they're going to realize that, you know, they've done the right thing in getting themselves educated, and now they're going to be so hampered in making progress towards the quote-unquote American dream. And particularly women who are going to have student loan debt, too. But because of the pay gap, they're going to end up paying thousands of dollars more for that education. That's going to happen before motherhood kicks in. They're going to realize the disparity there. And I'm hoping that since that sort of puts a target on them for what their economic choices are going to be and how they've been affected, I'm hoping for some real righteous indignation and moral outrage that will propel a real change on gender and how we do gender in this country.
So let's go to the future. And what do you see for our society 10, 20, and even 50 years from now?
The quote of Yogi Berra comes to mind. Predictions are really hard to make, especially about the future. We see the trends, but history is often made in really disjunctional moments where things do shift suddenly. And it's hard to predict if we will have such a break with what's been going on. I don't know, and, you know, I think about climate change a lot. That could mean something really different down the road, and that could change a lot of what we're talking about.
Sure.
So I'm really not, you know, I can't answer it.
Valerie?
I've been encouraged and then disappointed so many times that I almost don't want to be hopeful. But what I think about is how a year ago Governor Cuomo in New York said there's no appetite for paid family leave in New York State. And then a year later, by gar, New York passed a paid family leave bill.
Sure.
I was so surprised by that and so delighted by that, that while I'm not going to be optimistic because the U.S. has such a terrible track record in things having to do with women and care and making the economy work for everybody, but I do feel like I have to acknowledge that really positive change is absolutely possible, and it does happen. I just hope there's more of it.
We've been talking with two passionate women who have dedicated their lives to empowering mothers in our country. Ann Crittenden can be found at anncrittenden.com, Valerie Young at mommentum.org. I'm Sima Shapiro. To the listener, thank you for joining us. And until next time, I hope you take care.